Game Station. Thank you, Steve, for making us sound fabulous as always. Have a fabulous day.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth.
Hey, good morning. You are listening to KBOO, KBOO Portland, your community radio station, just a minute before 9 o'clock. We've got an hour to go before Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. Then at 10:15, it'll be Flashpoints. At 11, it's Between the Covers. And 11:30, Black Book Talk. That's all coming up this morning here on your Thursday. It is KBOO, KBOO Portland, your community radio station with Per Foggering sitting in for an hour, filling in for Teresa on Press Watch, and then his own show, Fight the Empire, at 9:30. So Per is coming up next on the Boo.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Well, good morning. This is a combined Press Watch and Fight the Empire show. I'm filling in for Teresa. And at 9:30, I will have a guest, Michael Brenner, and we'll be talking about America's drive to push its neoliberal politics on the rest of the world. And but that's at 9:30. In the meantime, we'll just kind of cover different things, and people can call in at 503-231-8187. Since this is Press Watch segment, boy, just this morning I was listening to the news, and I was listening to NPR's, you know, morning edition, and there was a little brief interview with Michel Flournoy. Now, for people who don't know, Michel Flournoy is a kind of a defense intellectual or whatever. She is rumored, if Hillary Clinton is elected president, Michel Flournoy may very possibly be Secretary of Defense. So she is a well-connected person in Washington, D.C. So NPR interviewed her as one of the little brief, four or five-minute interviews, and it just struck me that the interviewer was so obsequious talking to this woman. It was really kind of, I thought it was kind of embarrassing. I mean, I think he was trying to ask some pertinent questions, but he was so hesitant about it that it just, it was a little unnerving, you know? I mean, this is, I think people at NPR, you know, we like to compare them, well, at least they're better than, you know, Fox News and all that kind of stuff. But I think that being in the Washington area, you sort of get, you fall into that Washington mindset. They think that they are sort of the center of the universe, and it's kind of a company town. And so, anyway, that was very interesting, I thought, the way that this interview with Michel Flournoy. Another interesting article that I read, this comes from, originally it's from Politico, and it's about, I don't know how many people remember Roy Cohn. He was a young hotshot lawyer back when Senator McCarthy was trampling over people. And when Senator McCarthy was disgraced in Washington, Roy Cohn was kind of disgraced with him. And so Roy went back to New York City, where he was from, and he became a real fixer. He became, he always was a kind of a nasty guy, but he became a real insider and a fixer and a celebrity, and everybody who wanted anything done came to Roy Cohn. And, you know, he, one of the people who came to him for advice and was a young young real estate guy named Donald Trump. This was sort of back in the '80s, and Roy Cohn became Donald Trump's mentor and kind of a role model, I guess. And it's very interesting. Roy Cohn, he didn't believe. He was a very combative person. Well, here's something that Donald Trump himself said. This is Donald Trump told Newsweek back in 1979, if you need someone to get vicious toward an opponent, you get Roy. And that was very interesting. Well, you sort of see the seeds of that. You see what's happened, the way Donald Trump takes on anybody who criticizes him these days. He sort of got that that Roy Cohn tactic. He learned well, you know. And it's a very interesting article. It comes from Politico. So if you go on the web, it was published April 8th of this year. And the headline is, quote, he brutalized for you. And so, Donald, this is something, this is another quote here. This comes from Susan Bell, who was, for a long time, she was secretary to Roy Cohn. And she said, something Cohn had, Donald liked. And, that was, I guess, his general nastiness, and he didn't believe in settling lawsuits. He believed in fighting lawsuits in all kinds of sleazy ways. And if you read this article, you can really kind of get into it. So that tells us something about Donald Trump that maybe we didn't know before. You sort of wonder, I mean, when you, the more you know about Roy Cohn, the more you find to really kind of despise the guy. He was just sort of nasty in every way you can think of. And I think he's probably some way he was psychologically damaged. And one time I was kind of looking up kind of psychological concepts, and there's one called the Dark Triad. And this comes from Wikipedia. The dark triad is a subject in psychology that focuses on three personality traits: narcissism, Machiavellianism, and psychopathy. So the dark triad is sort of the idea that these three traits are not just, they're not distinct, or in some cases they sort of blend together into this kind of a super nastiness. And that's what the dark triad is. Now, narcissism is characterized by grandiosity, pride, egotism, and a lack of empathy. Machiavellianism is characterized by manipulation and exploitation of others, a cynical disregard for morality, and a focus on self-interest and deception. Psychopathy is characterized by enduring antisocial behavior, impulsivity, selfishness, callousness, and remorselessness. So you put them all together, and you've got the dark triad, and you've got Roy Cohn, and I think you've got Donald Trump, and who knows, maybe you've got other people. Let's not just single out Donald Trump as the as sort of the you know, the skunk at the picnic. I mean, it's I have to say that you know, Hillary Clinton does not come out so well if you want to look at morality and just sort of genuineness. You know, she has a record. She's been around Washington for quite a while, and she has a record of, you know, supporting wars, although she says that Iraq was a mistake. Well, la-di-da, folks. We were telling you that a long time ago. As far as Bernie Sanders goes, I think I have to disagree slightly. I think I think Joanne said earlier in her show that Bernie Sanders has been around for 30 years, which is true. But I would have to say that Bernie Sanders has not been one of the insiders in Washington. I mean, he was in the Senate, he was an independent, although he caucused with the Democrats. And of course, now he's running as a Democrat. But I don't think Sanders was ever an insider. He was there for a long time, but he was kind of doing his thing, you know, representing the state of Vermont. So I wouldn't call him an insider, not to the degree that Hillary is. One interesting thing you might ask might ask my guest when I get to him later on is this talk that if Hillary Clinton is elected president, her pick for Secretary of State will be Victoria Nuland. Well, Victoria Nuland, as I'm sure most of us know, is one of the instigators of the uprising in Ukraine that ousted a legally elected president, Yanukovych. He may have been sleazy, he may have been an operator, but he was democratically elected, and he was forced out of office by people in the streets who may have started out as demonstrators, but who were very quickly infiltrated by neo-Nazi troublemakers, violent people, and who were actually had their own snipers in a hotel in Kiev. So, Victoria Nuland was out there passing out cookies to the people in the streets, and egging them on. She was also the woman who was talking to, I think it was the ambassador to Ukraine, about who should be put in charge once Yanukovych was ousted. And she was quoted saying, "Yats is our man." Well, Yats refers to Yatsenyuk, who I think has since resigned. But he was sort of picked by her to be the president of Ukraine. So, So Victoria Nuland may very well be our next Secretary of State. It's very interesting that Victoria Nuland's husband is Robert Kagan, who is one of these neocons who have been sort of pushing for wars for a long time now. It sort of seems that's their stock in trade, and Robert Kagan is husband of Victoria Nuland, and he has come out and endorsed Hillary Clinton for president. This whole neocon crowd is sort of, they're sort of all related and married and close friends of each other. But it's a bigger group than just the neocons. You know, you have different branches. There are the, the sort of the conservative type warmongers. There are also the liberal interventionists, who I guess you might classify Hillary Clinton as being one of. And others would be Susan Rice and Samantha Power and a few others. You know, they have this idea that it's up to us to drive out dictators and put in democracy-loving people. Well, it doesn't seem to work out that way. We may drive out the dictators, but the ones who get put in are not democracy-loving, as we can see now in Ukraine. That country is falling apart, and sort of some doubt if it was ever a country in the first place, but their economy is in the tank. People are leaving the government. Yatsenyuk is out. a guy who was a Lithuanian who was sort of came into, was hired to sort of set their economy going. He resigned in disgust. Guy named Saakashvili, who used to be the president of Georgia until he was thrown out of office, and he was hired to do something, and he was he became a Ukrainian, an honorary Ukrainian, and I think he's a mayor of Odessa now. And there's also so the kind of people the responsibility to protect folks put in power are not very democratic themselves. I think Ukraine is a great example. If anybody wants to call in, the number is 503-231-8187. How do you, what do you think about the election? How do you think, what do you think about our choices? One thing that I keep hearing, it's sort of come out more recently, is that, oh, we do have a call. Thomas, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Good morning, Pierre. Yeah, it's. I was just thinking, based on your reflections and the topics discussed so far, you know, how truly unified the concepts of neocon, you know, neoconservative and neoliberal, you know, neocon in terms of foreign policy and what have you, and neoliberal in terms of economic orientation. And really, it's, you know, and that ties directly back together with essentially the convergence of the dominant economic and geopolitical platforms of the Democratic and Republican Party in the post Reagan era. It's interesting to reflect upon the term Reagan Democrat and to think about the fact that there's really been almost an entire internalization of the Reagan era foreign policy and the economic policy by the Democratic Party, and indeed the candidacy of Hillary Clinton is most thoroughly emblematic of that. I mean, you think back to her husband Bill Clinton, and think about how many truly huge changes have taken place. I mean, that relate to this transformation. You think about going back to the Anti-Terrorism Act of 1996, which was truly where the legal foundation for extraordinary rendition began.
And he was pushing the war, the Balkan Wars, which Hillary approved of. Yeah.
Absolutely, and there is a collective retrospective hallucination with the whole Yugoslav War. There's a whole giant backstory in what the U.S.'s real machinations were and how it relates to NATO basically hunting around for a reason to exist, and all the military-industrial contractors needing, essentially, a new raison d'etre, because we were fed the meme for, you know, ever since the guns and butter speeches of Eisenhower, we were fed this meme for decades about how once the evil Soviet Empire was brought to heel, we were going to have this giant peace dividend. And of course, with the collapse, with the economic collapse and the geopolitical decline of the Soviet Union, and of course the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact, you know, there was this atmosphere, not just in the U.S. but globally. Well, okay, where's our peace dividend? And indeed, Yugoslavia, you know, this whole idea of interventionism, of humanitarian interventionism, was truly forged there. And indeed, NATO was used in an offensive capacity for the first time in its history, which, of course, was actually is a violation of its charter. And I encourage anyone who really wants to go back, because I think this is important. This is still trotted out today, even by fairly progressive people, as being sort of a template for, you know, for the correct use of military force. You know, go back, search the internet for the writings and the work of Ramsey Clark, the former U.S. Attorney General under the Nixon administration, who was an outspoken critic. And if I'm trying to recall, yeah, was he also in the Johnson administration?
I think he was, yes. I think he was under Lyndon Johnson, the Attorney General, yes.
Right, that's it. Okay, mm-hmm. And he was an outspoken critic of the U.S., the war crimes in Vietnam, and particularly the Cambodia bombing. But, you know, there was a completely concerted effort. There was a bipartisan consensus, basically, in the establishment, liberal establishment, and, of course, the more right-wing establishment, to create, to fund special forces operations, to create essentially and also economic instability in the former Yugoslavia to gain a pretext for intervention. There's a whole body of work there. And the reason I say, you know, mention this is that we're looking at, as you touched upon, or more than touched upon, as you were beginning to unpack, the fact is that the core of the Democratic Party, the neoliberal neocon wing of the party, represented by Hillary Clinton, has absolutely chock full of these individuals that internalize this ideology, this renewed Cold War, this idea of American exceptionalism.
I think that's a uniting factor, is this idea of exceptionalism. That's what sort of pulls the neocons and neolibs together. They think that America is somehow qualified to go around, overthrowing governments all around the world because we are Americans, and so-called Madeleine Albright called us, the indispensable nation or something like that. It's very interesting. I think I was interviewing Ray McGovern a while back, and he pointed out that, if we're indispensable, does that mean that every other nation in the world is dispensable? Well, we seem to think so. We dispense of them right and left, you know.
Indeed. And of course, you know, one can reflect upon the fact that the American public, you know, the way the American public consumes such rhetoric is one thing. But if one steps outside of the box and thinks, how is the rest of the world trying to engage in multilateral cooperative, any sort of cooperative framework, be it in the UN or otherwise, how are they to view and how are they to react and how are they to strategize in relation to a country headed by leaders who essentially, from the beginning, give themselves a complete carte blanche and freedom of action on the world stage? And I would say that the situation as it stands now, you know, we're dealing with the dominant, at least formally on the surface, a Democratic candidate for president, Hillary Clinton, is someone who has backed regime change in Honduras and elsewhere, has blocked popular people's movements in Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about a situation where, ironically, we may have a Democratic president that is maybe the most hawkish president that we've had, more hawkish perhaps than the what I would call the Cheney administration, mm-hmm, of George W. Bush.
So, well, here's an interesting question. Suppose, if Donald Trump got elected, say Donald Trump becomes president and starts, throwing his weight around the world, I'm sure that the Democrats and the liberals will really be screaming from the rooftops. But if Hillary Clinton got elected and did the same things, I think a lot of liberals would fall into line, you know, because, well, she is one of ours. That's
we've seen exactly how that psychology played out in the Obama administration, if not neutralizing liberals, bringing them on board in just that fashion. And I would say that, you know, these bidding wars that we've gotten into, Hillary Clinton there's also this meme that since Hillary Clinton is a woman, that somehow she has some sort of a more soft touch. And we're also told to look to her about her question of experience in foreign policy. And I would say, yes, look at that experience.
Yeah, not very good. Not very good results, I'll say that.
Right. Well, very effective. But the thing is that the agendas that have been effectively promulgated are the ones that are antithetically related to peace and to multilateralism and et cetera. And I think that there's also maybe that additional psychology with Clinton. You know, I think she's shown that she wants to show it as a woman that she has, you know, not only that she got the whole tough on crime and super predator meme. And also, I think in terms of foreign policy, she has adopted throughout her career, she's tried to outbid the hawks. And indeed, you know, that she's essentially internalized in sort of that that Pentagon boosterism. And indeed, one might even say that she, you know, tongue in cheek, that she's become essentially the military-industrial complex's chief predator drone, essentially rubber stamping all of the Pentagon military programs. And I think it's an open question that whether a Clinton administration is going to be the more effective of, you know, is going to be not the lesser of the evil, but maybe the more effective of the evil. Whereas a Donald Trump, who ironically enough has even made some conciliatory gestures.
North Korea likes him.
Well, you know.
In fact, they says Hillary Clinton's trouble is she's dull.
Right.
Which is kind of interesting.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing with Donald Trump is he truly is a wild card. And he's extremely dangerous. And no one, I think, that has any presence of mind would advocate him being in the presidency. However, what do we absolutely know about Hillary Clinton? When you contrast the known foreign policy positions, you almost wonder which one. Well, actually, I think you could really make a strong case that Hillary Clinton is the known dangerous.
Well, you know, now I've been reading lately people are saying that Hillary's campaign seems to be slipping. There was some guy named Donald Shern who said, I guess he's some Washington insider, who said that that the Democratic establishment, they're getting kind of scared. They think that her campaign is not going well, and there's all sorts of possible moves to get somebody else in there. They don't want Sanders either. And so this talk of all of a sudden Joe Biden stepping in and being nominated, and he's recently said that he really regrets having bowed out, you know, several months before. And there's also talk that, you know, John Kerry, you know, who actually was a candidate one time, that he may be sort of put in place. It seems to me this would be kind of hard to do, considering that Bernie Sanders has been campaigning all these months and gotten a lot of support. But the fact that people are talking like this makes you wonder just, you know, how secure they feel about Hillary Clinton's candidacy.
Well, the thing is, you know, it depends on what part of the operation one feels is going well. As far as essentially coming in and with 400 some odd superdelegates before the first primary was ever held, you know, as far in the operation of sort of shoehorning herself in some of those caucuses and primaries, it's gone fairly well. But there's that little problem that she's what the I don't know if her or Donald Trump is actually the least favorable candidate in the race right now. And I think you have the two least favorable candidates ranked for president, the lowest approval ratings in history. So there's a little bit of problem of you know, what if you win the battle and get Hillary Clinton in there, but you lose the race in that or you lose the war in that. Essentially, everyone under the age of 45 never wants to have anything to do with the Democratic Party ever again. It's a real challenge.
Well, apparently, some of these super delegates, as part of this story that's going around, that you know, some of these super delegates, they can switch their pledges. They don't have to. They can go for any candidate they want.
Indeed.
And that they are certainly having second thoughts. But anyway, I want to thank you for your call and the observations. So I don't know. It's all of a sudden, this campaign has been going on for months and months and months. And it's just, it seems to be getting stranger all the time. And here we are, You know, I sort of wonder just what people around the world think of the United States. You know, we're going around pushing democracy on the rest of the world, and they look at our democracy and they sort of, you'll wonder how they feel about that. It's just, it's really kind of astounding to me that our democracy is in such kind of mediocre shape that the idea that we can be using it as an example to the rest of the world is really kind of laughable when you think about it. I don't know if we have any more callers. Sonny's on the line. Morning, Sonny.
Yes, good morning, Pear. And what a nice previous phone call. What bright commentary. And yours is always so broad-based and astute. You know, we've just had better and better and better talk radio occurring on KBOO from the morning, you know. And we're really lucky to have such wonderful hosts. People as yourselves, because you're all really smart.
Well, a lot of people are smart. You know, probably a lot of our callers, if they had a show, they could, do it too. You know, it's like people are very smart if they give them a chance, which is one thing that's, you know, I think that KBOO does. It gives people a chance. And, you know, it's like, and it pays off. I mean, people do have talents that kind of are. Not accepted by the mainstream, whatever, whether it's here or Washington, D.C. or wherever. So, you know, we can do it. We can do it. We are doing it. So
that's
why, to me, KBOO is such a wonderful place.
That's right. It's very important because it's all going to come down to us. And we do not have as much say as, you know, we're programmed into thinking, oh, you have a lot of say. You make a big difference. On a local level, block to block and human to human, we have a lot of power and such like that. But everything